You are listening to Larry Connors, USA.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
This is Larry Connors, USA. Larry Connors, USA.
I wasn't expected to make it to October and then to November and then to December. And yet, here I am. And today, I've got some problems, but I'm feeling pretty good today. God's with me today. So many people have put me first in all of this. And I understand now what Lou Gehrig meant, because I certainly feel like that. I feel extremely fortunate and lucky.
Those are the words of Rush Limbaugh from December last year. Of course, he passed away yesterday. This is Feb 18, 2021. We're going to spend more time today on praising Limbaugh and tell you some things that have been said about him and some more history on Limbaugh and what he's done, not only for talk radio, conservative talk, but also for liberal talk. What he's done for politics, what he's done for the business of broadcasting, it's a major passing. And there are very few legends that you could put with Limbaugh. One of them, of course, would be Paul Harvey. And I want to discuss Paul Harvey and Limbaugh in the next 2 hours as well. You heard Limbaugh in that tape piece from December 23rd, I think it was, one of his references to what he was battling, and talked about, you know, I now recognize how Lou Gehrig felt. Well, of course, Lou Gehrig was Major League Baseball player for the Yankees, 23 through 39, had the nickname the Iron Horse, All-Star 7 consecutive times, but then it came to Lou Gehrig having what was later classified as Lou Gehrig disease. It's incurable neuromuscular illness. But he stood in the center of Yankee Stadium thanking everyone and saying, "I am the luckiest man alive," and Limbaugh saying, "I certainly now really understand the meaning of that." But I will tell you this, in addition to just all the praise and the comments about Limbaugh, which were positive, he has his detractors, and I'm going to give some space to that. Because I think you should hear. I think you should hear and know what some of them have been saying. This death of Limbaugh has exposed the barest, vilest hate that exists among many in the nation on the left. And they want to accuse those on the right or conservatives of being hateful and exclusionary and racist, xenophobic, homophobic, whatever terms they want to throw out there. But Limbaugh's death accelerated the vile hatred from that side. I will tell you, I battled today. Do I even want to include it? Can I just look away? I could, but I'm going to call them out. I do not want it to pass unnoticed. So before we're finished over the next 2 hours, we're going to get into some of that. And I'm going to make the main part, but it does play a major portion of what we're going to do over the next 2 hours, only in the sense that This should be a time where even detractors could say something nice. No, not with the left hate. And, of course, what about COVID cases? You know, CNN was always updating COVID cases, COVID deaths, COVID numbers. They don't really do that anymore. Why? Ooh, that's right. We have a new president, Biden. And actually, COVID is going down. So when they do, they're going to point out that and say it's all Biden, obviously. And what about Cuomo? They're not really doing anything. New York Governor Cuomo either. Church trying to ignore him, step around him. And yet the pressure is building on Cuomo for a federal investigation of what he knew and did not tell about the nursing home deaths in New York State. And we could have schools open except for some who are insisting, no, it's too unsafe. Who's saying that? Bullies? Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation would join us. And you know who he says are the bullies? Teachers' unions. And then also this main energy grid blackout in Texas, initially leaving 4 million in the dark and the cold. Jason Isaacs, the director of Life Powered, that's a Texas public initiative, would join us to discuss the issue and why, if you listen to the left, it's because they don't have enough green energy. No, no, no. That's another lie. But before we wrap up today, I do want to conclude with something that will be uplifting for you. A legal immigrant talking about how much they enjoy our national anthem and why. Lock and load. Ready. On the right.
You can hear podcasts of this program at Larry Connors USA Facebook. Larry Connors USA Facebook.
Most of us are taking precautions to avoid COVID in public, but what are you doing to make sure your home is free of COVID? Wellington Environmental is the answer. And here's the great news. Wellington's average cost to professionally treat a home, less than $300. Less than $300. And the cost for treating most offices, not much higher. Be ready to copy a phone number to get on the schedule as soon as possible. First, let me remind you, if you want your own professional fogging device, Wellington sells them, price $500. But say you heard about it from Larry Connors, save $100. If you want your home or office professionally disinfected by Wellington, here's the number, 314-644-4930. Again, get on the schedule early, 314-644-4930, 644-4930. Be well with Wellington, Wellington Environmental. My sponsors keep this program on the air, so my thanks to John Beal Roofing, covering homes and businesses throughout the Midwest, best quality, lowest price. So when you need a roof, remember this sponsor for this program, John Beal Roofing, 1-800-NEW-ROOF, 1-800-NEW-ROOF.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
I wasn't expected to make it to October and then to November and then to December. And yet, here I am. And today, I've got some problems, but I'm feeling pretty good today. God's with me today. So many people have put me first in all of this. And I understand now what Lou Gehrig meant, because I certainly feel like that. I feel extremely fortunate and lucky. And because I have outlived the diagnosis, I've been able to receive and hear and process some of the most wonderful, nice things about me that I might not have ever heard had I not gotten sick.
Again, those are the words of Rush Limbaugh from a December 23rd program of last year while he was still battling lung cancer. Of course, by now I'm sure you know that he passed away yesterday at age 70, losing that battle to cancer. And as he said, I kind of a blessing, the way he describes it, the sense that he was diagnosed as he was, and he never really played it up on the air other than to let the audience know early in the diagnosis almost a year ago, well, a little over a year ago, announcing to the audience what he had. He said, I don't want to become a cancer patient on the air, and a lot of other people deal with it on a constant basis. No one knows about them, but I just need to let you know because I'll probably have to miss several programs. I want you to know why and what's going on. And, of course, immediately an outpouring of love and support and prayers. And yes, also those basically saying it would be good if it's sooner than later. We're going to get into some more of those attitudes in the second hour. But the praises for Trump I'm sorry for Limbaugh also came from President Trump, saying he's a legend. And someone's already asked Trump, would you take over the EIB Network Excellence in Broadcasting microphone? He said no, and no one really can. I agree. No one can really do that. And it's not just doing the job he did, but it's also a business model. The way the Limbaugh program was put together and produced, sold around the nation, many of the major stations and major cities had to actually pay to carry the program. And then on top of that, then they had to basically give away a lot of their inventory that they would sell for local spots, because that was going to go for the Limbaugh program and its sponsors. And there were many major markets where local sponsors were hard to even buy into the program. They didn't know what he was going to say, what he was going to do. They considered him a loose cannon from time to time, and they just didn't want to be caught in the crossfire. And that is in part mainly why many of the major sponsors never were part of his program, be it something like General Motors or AT&T. And, of course, also because you have those on the left always saying he's a bigot, he's racist and everything, and they still push that storyline. You cannot be a conservative, apparently. You cannot have your independent thinking unless you are a bigot or you're a racist, in the view of the leftist. And, of course, one of his colleagues they often referred to as Mr. Snerdley was a black man that worked for him for many years who loved working it and made comments on the air with the passing of Rush that how much he was going to miss him and loved him. Again, we'll get into more of that a little bit later. But I'm looking at a piece also written by Molly Hemingway, the senior editor of The Federalist, and it's titled Perfect. I mean, it's a perfect title in the sense that she says, Limbaugh taught a generation how to fight back against the corrupt media, the totalitarian left. As she then states in her essay, there was no more prominent conservative who represented the right half of the country for 30 years than Rush Limbaugh. It is not too much to say that he gave an entire generation of Americans a way to think and talk about the politics and meaning of America. He gave the people a vocabulary to fight back against a portion of the left that has grown increasingly anti-American. That's correct on so many levels. There was another issue that I had raised yesterday in relating a story about reference to Limbaugh and the fairness doctrine, that he had challenged it, and I can't find the exact piece of copy we're reading yesterday on it. I mean, I am surrounded by numerous pieces of copy on Limbaugh, but I did have a listener, Tim Allen, take note of that. He said, well, actually, Limbaugh never acknowledged that the fairness doctrine gave him the right to go forward. I think I'd made some reference, and it was an attributable source, and I don't have it here in front of me, that because of the fairness doctrine, it was done away by Reagan when he got rid of it, that it basically gave Limbaugh an opportunity to go forward. The fairness doctrine in the mind of many was that if you're going to give one side of you, you always have to present the other side. And if it were interpreted that way, well, then Reagan tore it up, got rid of it. But I'm looking at a transcript because Tim Allen, again, Tim, I should say, writing me as one of the listeners, since he did not put it on a public forum, it's to email. I won't give you his full name. But Tim did point out something that Limbaugh had said, referenced the fairness doctrine. I was unable to lift the actual sound because it's part of the archives of the Limbaugh file at this point. But it began with him talking about an interview that was going to be scheduled by Ted Koppel was reaching out to him. He said, Ted Koppel was trying to get me to do a 45-minute interview. He wanted to go actually to Limbaugh and do a 45-minute interview, and Limbaugh's kind of indifferent about it. He said, my first appearance on Nightline was to oppose Al Gore on climate change, global warming, environmentalism. And he said, now they've got people like Ted Koppel wanting to talk to me, and I thought, yeah, I don't really need Ted Koppel. I don't know if I want to do it or not. So he took some time to deliver it. We'll get into that part of the story in the second hour as well. But to the issue of the fairness doctrine, He pointed out, and I'm reading the transcript from Limbaugh at that point, he said, the fairness doctrine didn't stop anybody from doing anything. Well, it did because the government regulates broadcasters. The government grants licenses, and broadcasters have to go through ascertainment every 5 or 10 years to get their license renewed. That's when they have to show they're fully serving the community, when they have to show their programming, how they're balancing this, balancing that, which everybody was. You've heard that many times on a television or radio station that they list that if you have any issues or complaints you want to file with us, now is the time to be heard as we renew our license, and you're welcome to send your mail here or there, whatever. And he went on to say you had to do that to get your license renewed. It did not mean that for 3 hours after me there had to be a liberal if you were on a station. That's what he's trying to say. He said you could have a liberal on for an hour at midnight. The fairness doctrine would have been complied with. He said, anyway, Reagan got rid of it, tore it up. I was doing this program for 3 years before the fairness doctrine was gotten away with or done away with, he said. The fairness doctrine didn't stop me, and the fairness doctrine did not unleash me. He said the program stands on its own. He said the fact that the fairness doctrine was eliminated in 87, liberals love to explain that because it can't be my talent. It's got to be the quality of the program. It can't be anything substantive to explain all of this now, conservative alternative media. It has to be conservatives got rid of a key government regulation. Sir, we are eliminating the fairness doctrine so as to spawn a new conservative media. That's not how it happened. In fact, Limbaugh continued in stating, the fairness doctrine is one of the greatest false gods, if you will, straw men that you've ever seen constructed. As I say, I was doing this exact program 3 years in Sacramento, California, and in fact, only one time in those 3 years was equal time demanded. And you know what we did? It was some preacher who got mad at something I said, who wanted to tell the virtues of life in Senegal and Africa. As a retort to something, I'd said the guy was a professional harasser of radio stations. The management came to me and said, well, we got Dr. So-and-so. I said, bring him on. If he's complaining, we'll interview him for half an hour. They said, yeah. That's almost like inviting the guy into the Lions Den, isn't it? He said, we brought the guy in. He shows up, starts talking about what he likes about Senegal as opposed to Atlanta, wherever he was at that point. He said, I interviewed him. He walked out 30 minutes, satisfied. He got to be on the radio. He got to be around and tell everybody he stood up to Rush Limbaugh. He said, but as it was not the fairness doctrine that had demanded it. It was the management of the station coming to me and saying, this guy's a professional harasser. And they were afraid I didn't want to do it. He said, sure, bring him in. In other words, I'll be glad to take him on. And among those praising Limbaugh, who knew him personally and extensively, Fox News' Sean Hannity.
It's just heartbreaking. And I watched him since the day, it was over a year ago now, that he announced that he had you know, stage four lung cancer. And he was very honest with his audience, but he said, I don't want to be a cancer patient on radio. I want to talk about the things that he loved. He was, you know, to break it down very simply, God, faith, family, country. And he meant it. And he lived it. And he embodied it. And there are now generations of us that have literally, he's changed the hearts and minds of generations of Americans single-handedly. And when he started in nationally syndicated radio, there were about less than 200 talk radio stations in this country. Now there are like 4,000.
4,000 talk radio stations in the nation. He basically also saved the AM programming and then ended up also helping save FM programming as a lot of FM stations began to carry him. Before you had Limbaugh, you had probably the biggest would be Paul Harvey. There was also a guy by the name Earl Nightingale. Some might remember that. In fact, when I started radio in West Texas, one of my jobs was to, we got at that time programs on a big LP disc, a 33 and a third disc, for those of you who know what that is. And then we would play each program as scheduled off of that. That's how we got the Earl Nightingale program. Again, a powerful thinker and spreading his message. And then you had Paul Harvey, and we would take him live each day. Paul Harvey for ABC News, and he had his own style. He was on some 1,200 radio stations, at that time. I have been honored from time to time to be compared to Paul Harvey by voice or presentation, and again, that's an honor for me. I've also been said, what are you trying to do now? You're trying to be a Rush Limbaugh. No, I wasn't trying to be a Paul Harvey. I wasn't trying to be a Rush Limbaugh. But I admire what both of them contributed, not only to broadcasting, but to our nation. Paul Harvey was invoking the very essence of the good in this country, pretty much, on a daily basis. He would tell a mix of stories and news and so forth with his own style. But it also was just the Norman Rockwell America. Now, for a lot of folks, they said, well, that's not me. I'm not white. And that's what Norman Rockwell basically was in the view of his style. So I understand some folks hesitating, and yet I know Paul Harvey crossed racial lines, too, on the response in the audience. Limbaugh was more confrontational and in-your-face type thing about this is what I stand for. Two different styles, two major legends. I owe a lot to both of them. And this nation does as well. Take a break when we come back. The bullies that are keeping schools from opening. That's right, some bullies. Stand by, please.
This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
So, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying that teachers may not have to be vaccinated to return to school, depending on the coronavirus caseload of the community. Chicago, they're still trying to get the teachers' union to come back in, and they will not, because they believe everything should be done the way they want, and they're really looking for using it as leverage for additional items more than just getting protection before they go teach a class. But Pelosi, Democrat, of course, of California, says school districts really need more money to make safety improvements for reopening. And that's why she's saying we need to have President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief legislation. She says, I think teachers should be vaccinated. I don't know if they must be vaccinated before going in. Well, which is it? I think they should be, or I don't know if they had to be vaccinated. Well, the bottom line is, if you're going to believe the science, because they liked the science when it worked for them, Anthony Fauci had said previously, we don't need to vaccinate all teachers to work a school to get schools open. The CDC had the same attitude, but somebody got to them. Somebody said, you need to kind of rephrase that a little bit. So they basically issued newly released guidance stating it is possible for schools, quote, even in areas of the highest community spread, to reopen safely, at least in a hybrid fashion, without teachers getting vaccinated first. What does that mean? Well, who knows? They're constantly adjusting and moving the goalposts. There's a group called Burbio.com. It's a school reopening tracker, found that as of Saturday, 48.8% of K through 12 public school students in the U.S. were attending in-person school every day. I will guarantee you they're not in blue cities and blue states. Then it goes on to say about a third of U.S. students were in virtual-only schools, the remainder a hybrid of both virtual and in-person. And remember the other day that the Jen Psaki of the White House suggested the administration's goal was in the first 100 days to have more than 50% of the schools open at least one day per week? Well, when Biden was questioned about the town hall meeting, he said, no, that's a mistake. He said, our actual goal is opening the majority of K-8 schools at the end of the first 100 days. But bullies are still standing in the doorway. And by bullies, we're talking about teachers' union. And of course, Biden is a strong ally to the unions. He wants teachers prioritized in getting vaccinations. States will be making the determinations. And so far, they have not allowed teachers to be moved up in the line for eligibility. Well, Biden says, yes, you should do that. Well, again, that's up to the states to make that determination at this point. But really, what the Democrats and left want to do, they want that $1.8 trillion package. Oh, I stand corrected, $1.9 trillion. Hey, what's the difference of 0.1 trillion, 0.1 trillion up or down, huh? Still talking about real money at that point, right? The problem is it has been so weaponized, and those suffering are the kids. Most private Catholic schools, or Catholic schools, of course, being private, they're open. Many other private schools are fully open. What is the stopping gap? The unions, in most cases, in blue cities and blue areas. And I'm sure there are teachers in those ranks that really want to be back in the school, and they know how this is harming the kids. But the leadership is calling the shots. And who wants to speak out against the leadership if other colleagues at your school are really all for just stay out as long as we can? There's a piece that was written for Fox News, an opinion piece. A guy was doing a documentary. He said, I was in the south side of Chicago. A young man asked me what I was doing. I told him I'm doing this as a study, a documentary on education. He said, I've been kicked out of two high schools, never graduated. Mother worked two jobs to provide for me and my sister, and I've never learned how to read. And this guy's in his mid-20s. And that is a shame in this nation at this point. And, of course, the other problem is too many times teachers just pass the student forward just so they didn't have to deal with them again. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation with a closer look at the bullies at the door and how it's harming our children, all at the expense of politics. Please stand by.
You can email Larry at LarryConnorsUSA@gmail.com. LarryConnorsUSA@gmail.com.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
Welcome back. So we're talking about how the schools are not being open despite the CDC saying you can, and then they even came out with a school reopening plan, but the measures are so strict. A Brown University professor pointing out that currently few places in the U.S. meet the criteria they're trying to impose in the school. And, of course, keep in mind, the many cases, unions are the bullies at the door, not letting the students come in. Joining us now, Jonathan Butcher. He's with the Heritage Foundation. A lot of research in education, I should say, an expert on education policy, school choice programs. Glad to have you with us, Jonathan.
Great to be with you.
I'm looking at a piece that you penned a while back, and also one of your colleagues had done something similar about these schools and getting them open, and it still keeps coming down to everything I see. And it's been primarily blue cities, big blue cities, L.A., Chicago, Philly, New York, D.C. Teacher opposition is keeping the doors closed. Go ahead, sir.
Well, it's the unions. I think that the unions don't always represent what all of their members would like to do. And I think especially now that we have a number of studies showing that schools are not super spreaders, that we must be having conversations about how to at least give students the option to be back in person.
Well, Pelosi just today said that teachers, well, let me read her quote here because it's confusing to me. Maybe you can help me straighten it out. She said today, I think teachers should be vaccinated. I don't know they must be vaccinated before going in. And she said, of course, I want everybody to be vaccinated. I certainly want our teachers to be. But depending on what the situation is in their area, it may or may not be necessary. So in other words, she's kind of, well, I guess we the way. But she knows that the blockage at the door, as you said, are the labor unions standing up saying, we're not going back till we get everything we want. And it's often not just protection from COVID, is it?
Well, it's easy to take both sides because then you're never wrong, right?
Yeah, you're right.
If you equivocate.
That makes you a good politician. You're right. Go ahead.
That's right. And so that's a bit what we've seen from the administration, too, because at first, you know, the president said, well, I'd like most schools to be open by 100 days, in his first 100 days in office. And then his press secretary said, well, more than half, at least one day a week in person, which they've since changed. And the president said, no, no, we want more than that. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth going on. I think what we've got to be serious about is that first, parents are not happy with only online learning that the districts have put together so far. Kids are failing. The rates of D's and F's have gone up around the country. We've had very unsettling news about suicides in places like Nevada and other cities. So this is very much a concern for especially large cities around the U.S. And for unions to be getting in the way, this is very much a policy issue. This is very much something where state lawmakers should be prepared to give students other options.
Well, but again, as we said, it's not just about the, quote, safety of the teachers or even the students. The union positions, as pointed out by one of your colleagues at Heritage, like in L.A., the union's demands for reopenings include defunding police, a moratorium on charter schools in L.A. Chicago, they want to include rent abatement. What does that have to do with protecting the teachers in front of the class or the kids themselves?
Well, and that is very common from the unions. So last summer, when the national headquarters of the AFT said that they would back up local chapters if they decided to strike, local chapters immediately got together and released a statement saying, forgive rents and mortgages, like you were saying, defund police both in and out of school, especially when it comes to school safety. So they've taken this and used it to elevate their other policy goals.
And even among those on that side, there's dissension. I mean, the Chicago mayor, Lori Lightfoot, I don't know how many times she's threatened them, said, I want them open. You got to open it. That's my best and last and final offer. And they're still not open. Now what they're into is basically the teachers union just reaching an agreement to reopen schools, but only allow in-person 2 days per week. And that excludes high school students. That doesn't begin for nearly another month. High school students are critical. I'm not saying we want to drop any of the kids. But high school students, they need that prep if they're going to try to go to a higher education afterwards. If they're not getting it, if they're coming out fully unqualified, they're just being passed by. In fact, how are they grading students over this last year when they were not in school that much, whether or not it was Zoom?
Well, sure, college or the workplace, right?
Or the workplace,
you're
right.
We need to get these kids no matter what future they've got. And look, what you just described in Chicago is exactly right, and it's now playing out in the very same way in Philadelphia. The district called teachers back in person. The union said no. And then the mayor of Philadelphia is now negotiating through a mediator with the union. So it's all playing out in very much the same way.
You point out, in fact, I was going to bring that up. That's a piece you wrote about how to get kids back in school. And you were focusing on Philadelphia. And you state that nothing during the COVID-19 era indicates a problem, and you already talked about the school district struggling to keep students engaged before the pandemic, and nothing during the COVID-19 indicates it's gotten any better. Things may be even worse as the district and the union keepers have agreed not to resume in-person instruction in a city where 37%, more than one in three, were found to be chronically absent before COVID started.
Well, that's right. And now that you have kids being asked on their own to log in each day, and what the superintendent of schools in Philadelphia said at the very beginning of this school year was that they weren't going to hold kids responsible if they couldn't get online because of internet problems or computer problems, which I don't know if that just meant the first week, if that meant the whole year. I mean, you know, who knows? But if you carve out such a wide berth there, I mean, who knows how many students have been consistent. There's one study that was done over the past 6 months that said it is very possible that as many as 3 million children from disadvantaged backgrounds have not had any formal schooling since last March.
3 million?
3 million.
Now, you're listening to Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation. Does that lend credence to what Biden was trying to say the other day at his town hall meeting or at wherever he mentioned that, you know, we have a lot of minorities, black and brown, that they basically saying they're not computer savvy. They don't know how to get onto the internet. Now, there may be some areas where they don't have effective internet, but I got the impression you're saying they're just not smart enough, which really was a demeaning, I think, racist approach and attack on them. But if we have 3 million out there that, as you say, have not been getting any schooling like that, I mean, we have a major crisis coming down the road.
And it's going to drive, I think, even further apart this achievement gap that has effectively been the same and unchanged for about 50 years between low-income students and their peers. And this is going to widen that gap. I think it's putting at an even further disadvantage those kids who needed help before the pandemic even set in.
And yet you'd also pointed out, since you were talking about Philadelphia, you said that most private and Catholic schools open with in-person hybrid plans already. A recent report from Catholic Philly showing that around the country, more than 90% of Catholic schools have been open for in-person learning and working within sanctioned health guidelines. I guess God is protecting the Catholic students and won't watch over the public schools. What's that?
Well, and even the numbers show that we're at about 44% right now of public schools that are open for in-person learning. So it's concentrated in these areas where unions are especially powerful, I think. I think, you know, some states backed off when we had the spike over the last 4 to 6 weeks, which appears to have, you know, at least for now, not just plateaued, but actually gone back down. So, you know, I think throughout all of this roller coaster, we have got to give kids some stability. And this on-again, off-again approach that unions are perpetuating is not making it any better.
You mentioned that 40%. Before you joined us, I was quoting maybe the source you were as well, the Burbio.com school reopening tracker. 40.8% of K through 12 public school students were attending in person in school every day. And my point being that out of that 40.8%, I would guarantee you they were not in blue-controlled cities and dominated areas.
Well, in all likelihood, I mean, I think, you know, it's these places that have where policymakers have taken more authority, really, than they should have over public services during the pandemic. And now, with where we are today and what students need, these same state policymakers need to be creating more options for kids to get back to in-person, whether that's through private schools or charter schools or something else. But most state legislatures are in session now, and they should be working on behalf of students.
But they do not want to give up any power. And as you said, they should be working for the students. And the key point, especially with the Democrats all concerned, as we all should be, about make sure everyone gets a good education and health, and particularly some minority groups are going to need more help along the way because of past lack of schooling as well. But right now, those being hurt the worst are those who are in the minority groups.
That's right. Those that needed help, even before the pandemic set in, we had an achievement gap. Look, there are cities where 10% or less of the students are scoring at what would be considered a mastery level in math, right? And so we're talking about places like Detroit, Cleveland, cities like that. And there are other places, Philadelphia, D.C., where you have 50% or more in some cases who are below basic in math, right? I mean, that's not even close to where
and that was before
was.
COVID.
And this was 2 years ago.
Yeah, two years ago. And everyone you named was a blue-controlled area, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, so it'd be. Jonathan, I want to thank you very much for taking time on this. This is a pressing subject. I agree we're facing a problem with the issue now, and it's going to be deeper down the road, and not only for the nation, but for the kids. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
You bet. Jonathan Butcher. So in the midst of the cold wave, Senator Cruz did something that has absolutely incensed the left. I mean, they are trying to make the biggest story out of this. There's no story, but we'll have some fun with it. Stand by, please.
You can connect with Larry on Twitter at Larry Connors USA.
Give me the honky tonk. This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
You know, of course, about the frigid and deadly temperatures many in the nation have been suffering, and in particular across Texas, 4 million without power for a period of time. Now I think it may be down of maybe only 3 million. Maybe it's halved after that by now. But NBC is reporting that according to the Energy Reliability Council of Texas, saying that the Texas power grid was, quote, now I'm quoting here, the NBC reporter of supposedly quoting officials with the Energy Reliability Council of Texas that oversees their energy, the Texas power grid was, quote, seconds or minutes, not hours, away from catastrophic failure. The tweet states rolling blackouts were implemented to stop the situation from becoming far worse than it might otherwise have been. And today, the ERCOT, that being the Energy Reliability Council of Texas, said it's made significant progress in restoring power. I'm still seeing, I think now, here's an update. Now they're saying just under 500,000 still don't have power. That's down from the 4 million earlier. Now, that's a big issue. Were they that close to, quote, a catastrophic issue? Texas gets something like 25% of its power from these windmills, and they froze because of the severe cold and the sleet and the snow that they didn't expect to have. And how did they get the turbines going again? They had to use fossil fuel for a de-icer to get on them to clear the ice. And they had to get it up there using helicopters, which use fossil fuel, to fly up and do it. We're going to have an expert coming up in the second hour who is really deals with the Texas energy on a constant basis. And I want his opinion on some things going on, because if you listen to the left, all of this is really the failure, not of what we now consider the windmills freezing, but because they did not have enough green energy in Texas. I ain't going to have a hard time buying that story, but we'll see what's going on with it, get his opinion. But here's something the left is pushing, as this is a major story. Did you know this? In the midst of this winter storm, Senator Ted Cruz, Texas, Republican, flew to Cancun, Mexico with his family. And they're acting like, oh, my God, he fled the state with his family to go to Cancun. They are circulating photographs of Cruz at the airport, slamming him for leaving the state amid a major crisis. The response from Cruz is, school canceled for the week. Our girls asked to take a trip with friends. Want to be a good dad? I flew down with them last night. I'm flying back this afternoon. My staff and I are in constant communication with state and local leaders to get to the bottom of what happened in Texas. We want our power back, our water on, our home safe. My team and I will continue using our resources to keep Texans informed and safe. But the bottom line is, so what? If you had the ability to get out of a frozen area and go to somewhere nice and warm, would you not do it? I did, back over New Year's Eve. It wasn't that cold. I went to Cancun for a while. And you would go somewhere warm, be it Scottsdale, if they are actually warm now compared to what they had been. But they want to say, look what this guy did. Now, there was only one time that really became a major issue. And Cruz, again, being a U.S. senator, obviously has a vested interest in Texas and what's going on. No doubt about that, and his constituents. But there's nothing he can't do from Cancun if he chose to stay there with his kids. He's doing it in the state anyway. But here I will take you back to Chicago. Many years ago, boy, am I drawing a blank on her name suddenly. I had her name, and I was just thinking about it. Chicago mayor at the time, female, and I'm not trying to put any burden upon that gender. I'm just saying that's who it was. Now, think of her name, hopefully. But anyway, they had a major snow crisis in Chicago. Everything shut down. We're talking about, I think, back in the 80s, maybe, something like that. And she left and went to, I want to say, something like Puerto Rico or something. Now, she was in constant contact with her people as well. But when the folks of Chicago realized she had gone down there and left them suffering in the cold, they were ballistic. She should be here suffering with us. In other words, if we're suffering, you got to be here suffering. Now, whether she maintained I could still do what's needed to be done from down here, and I'm staying in constant contact, but that wasn't good enough for them, and it cost her the election the next time around. So I guess that's what's really at heart here. They're thinking, you know, we can duplicate with Cruz, get rid of him now, because I can see the campaign ads now. It got cold as Hades, and Cruz flew to Cancun, leaving us to suffer. Democrats on the left, many of them are all about suffering, being victims. They always want to call you a victim and make you suffer. All right, so coming up in the next hour, we are going to spend more time on the Texas grid problem and how much green energy did or did not contribute and or would have been worse. And also more on Rush Limbaugh, the praises, but also I am going to allow you to hear and see and listen to some of the vile hatred spewing from members of the left over a man's death. This shows you the underbelly of the left is just as sordid and swampy and nasty as you imagined. That's coming up in the next hour. Please stay with us.
This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
You've been listening to Larry Connors USA. Please listen to previous and future podcasts.